right. My name's Steve, and I'm still an alcoholic. If I fast forward, rewind, go in and out, loop backwards, rub my chest, stutter, it's all out of nervousness. And quite honestly, I'm scared. This is one of my fears, public speaking and speaking of my issues, right? You know, I hear all these readings, you know, 3 and 5 and some of the 12 traditions, and just certain things start, especially this morning as I'm backstage, right? I feel kind of cool. And I'm thinking, I'm like, oh, the results were nil, or, you know, we had to let go absolutely, or pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization. Like, all these readings mean so much to me because it's all sinking nails in why I'm here, right? Because that was my life. Like, it's sending these nails home, and it just shows to me, like, how much that I need this program, you know, and how much it's changed my life. What it was like, what happened, what it's like now. Well, what it was like was, I was a 24-hour drinker. I could go a couple hours, and that was about it before I'd start shaking violently and sweating and feeling like death was overtaking me. And that's exactly what it felt like. If that's what death is, that's what I was feeling. And I was living in a little town. I'm not knocking little towns, right? Like this town itself at all. I was living in a little town north of the Las Vegas Valley, town of Malapa Valley, residency of about 12,000 people. And it was heaven to me. You know, I grew up in Valencia, you know, all snooty, blah, blah, blah. And I went and visited this town, and it was like the Wild West out there. You know, 24-hour bars, shoot guns right out in your backyard and ride your dirt bike right out your driveway and just be gone into Utah or Arizona and just keep going. I fell in love with it. And I took my alcoholism out there with me. And surprisingly, I don't know how it progressed, but it progressed very heavily. And it came to a point where, you know, I was waking up, I was having seizures because I was lacking alcohol. You know, I was hospitalized a couple times because of that. And I crossed that invisible line that we talk about where I became 100% physically dependent upon alcohol for me to get through my day, do anything, to pass out, I needed it, let alone hold a job. I was in a nightmare, and I managed to acquire 3 DUIs out there, and you know, every cop, the 4 cops that were in this town, they all knew me. They knew my truck. They knew what I did. I drove around with tall cans all day long. That was my deal. Is I drank and drove. That's what I did, and they knew me. And it was ridiculous. I was a mess, right? Complete unmanageability, and I did a couple rehabs. I did Salvation Army in 2014. I managed to do 4 months, and I got out, stayed with the program, went to a couple meetings here and there, and I was a week away from a year sober, and I got the case of the fuckets. Excuse me, but I don't know. Got a case of the fuckets, and the reason is, I look at it now, I wasn't doing anything about my alcoholism. I was still going into the bars, gambling, and drinking Sprite and cranberry juice, right? Like, I didn't change anything. I had no program. I had no God. And that's the number one thing. But, you know, so I went back to my drinking, and within a week, I was back to having to drink. Like, just how I was, right where I left off. So when you hear that, it is so true. You leave right where you left off. Or you start right where you left off. And so after that last DUI, I went back into Salvation Army, did 6 months, and this time I went in with, I had nothing left. All that we talk about in Chapter 3, like taking a trip, not taking a trip, switching from scotch to brandy, drinking only natural wines, right? You know, all those things, I did all those things. I eliminated all the things that I could do humanly possible, relying on other people, all this. I went in with a clean slate, open mind. I was a sponge when I went in, and I just absorbed, and I just took everything that they were offering me. I took their higher power, which was a Christian-based program, and I still have that God of my own understanding today. And I stuck with the program when I got out of treatment. Now, I was in a relationship. Here's a rewind, right? I was in a relationship with a girl I found out there when I moved out there that was my spitting image of me drinking. We were so compatible. It was beautiful, right? And I moved back in with this woman. That lasted 3 months. 3 months of her not changing anything to keep my sobriety, right? So I was on my own. I kept going to meetings. She kept doing what she was doing. She wasn't coming home. I put two and two together, figured it out. And I knew I was on that verge of that decision. What do I do? Stay here and drink? Because there's nothing else to do in that town but go to the lake, drink, ride dirt bikes, drink. That's just what it was for me. That's what I moved into. So I literally had my psychic change, my spiritual awakening. I was digging a ditch doing landscaping, and I got a phone call. And it was someone just bringing light to a situation that was going on in my life that I knew was happening, but I didn't want to see it. But it was this outside influence. And just that, when I read that, I literally, I can't explain it. I can't explain it, but it was not me. And it was not me who was making this decision or making me feel the way that I was feeling at this moment. And I made the decision that I'm leaving and I'm going back home. I'm coming back to Southern California. And I set a date and I did everything right? I put in a 2 weeks notice at my work. I've done plenty of those, but that 2 weeks only lasted a day because I didn't show up the next. I felt responsible, right? Did my 2 weeks. I finished my 12 steps with my sponsor that I had out, that I had in recovery and continued to work with them outside of treatment. So now I'm here. I took a year after I moved back. My sobriety date is March 23rd, 2016. And, I knew where to go. I went right to the rafters. I got into the program. I got a sponsor and I started working. And, I owe the life I have today because of this program. If it wasn't introduced to me in that treatment, that was my third treatment, but I figured it was my second. That time and just literally just letting go of everything I was trying to hold on to, which nothing was working. Nothing helped me in the long run. That I wouldn't have the life that I have today. I wouldn't be able to go with Phil Adams over here to come see you guys and, ride our motorcycles to the Sierras. It just doesn't happen for someone like myself. If you told me that this would be my life today, 2.5 years ago, you hear it all the time. You would have said you're absolutely insane, right? But today I have a God of my own understanding and I get to my meetings and I go to work. I'm just, it's plain, right? I pay bills. You hear it all the time, but it's all I need. Anything I think of it. And the one thing I'm so grateful for is being able to wake up and be free and just be free from alcohol. Because that obsession and that craving was fucking insane. And I'm getting the chills right now, I'm sorry. It was a scary, scary time for me for a very long time. The only friends I had were my drinking buddies. I moved away from my family because I didn't have to see them. Anything is better than the way it was. Today I have real relationships, with my family, with my fiance. I have a fiance who's two years, 3 months sober, thank you. Anything is better than the way it was, I really don't know what else to say besides that I am so grateful for you guys, and and this program, and it's given me a life beyond my wildest dreams. And that's another thing. I was such a skeptic when people would say that. I would say, there's no fucking way, right? Your wildest dreams, my wildest dreams is being on a yacht with a full bar and ounces of cocaine and methamphetamine, right? Like, it's just me. That's my wildest dreams. But no, it's the simplicity of the life I have today. I wake up, I go to work, I have a job I never thought I would have. You know, I have friends who genuinely care. I have just people who love me and actually care about my own well-being and me towards them. And I take life as life happens. You know, Phil and I just read Daily Reflections this morning, and it was, we can just be in today, you know, and it's God's will today. I'm very thankful for you guys. I was a random weird shoe-in on this 10-minute. But I was nervous as shit. I couldn't even eat that delicious looking breakfast burrito. You know what I mean? But I wanted to get up here and tell you guys some drunkalog antics that I put myself through, but you guys all heard that shit before. There are some good ones. But anyways, I truly am grateful for you guys' program, and I think I have some more reading to do. Thank you. That's all I have. Thank you. All right, well, welcome back. I'd like to introduce our main speaker for the morning, Phil.
Bill Adams, alcoholic. So, thank you, Stephen. And thanks, Springville. It's a wonderful opportunity. Ben Benedetti, the guy who was supposed to be here, he had a family issue come up last night about 7:30 or 8 o'clock after dinner, and he said, can I talk to you guys? And we walked off to the side. He says, I have to go home. And Steve says, you're bullshitting, right? He goes, no, I have to go home. There's something with my stepdaughter who just came out of a recovery program and got off the plane drunk after 90 days. And she's 35, and she's been struggling with what we struggle with, drugs and alcohol. And so he went home to be of service with his other fiancé. I'm the stand-in fiancé because she couldn't come up originally. And so when we got to dinner last night, they said, yeah, you're all set for you and your fiancé. And they're looking at three guys. And I said, I'm the fiancé. So I love Ben Benedetti. He was here when I was here last time. This is not my first time in Alcoholics Anonymous. So I'll tell you a little bit about myself. Grew up in Los Angeles. I, like many of us, I didn't start out with alcohol. I had a dad who left when I was 4, a mom who worked 2 jobs to provide, and I was the kid waiting for dad to come by on Saturdays as I got older, and he would never show up because my dad's addiction was women. So my mom was working all the time, and what I chose to focus on was initially was food. We couldn't have, my mom worked for Sears for 43 years. I used to wear those Fat Boy Tuscan jeans and the cheap Sears t-shirts and shoes, and everybody else was wearing Levi's and JCPenney's crew neck t-shirts and nice tennis shoes. So I was resentful from a very young age. And so when we used to go to the market, Howe's Market on Melrose, I would go hide behind the potato chip rack, and I would sit there and shove my face full of potato chips until my mom would scream, and then I'd go meet her. And then growing up in elementary school, I'd be coming home with a friend of mine. His mom They were Hispanic, and she would make rice, beans, and tortillas, and I'd sit there and I'd eat with Javier, and then I'd go over to my aunt's house about two blocks away, and she'd say, "Did you eat?" And I'd say, "No, I didn't eat." And am I in trouble already? Okay, sorry. Let me put this up here. Is that better? Okay. I'd lie and say, "No, I didn't eat." And she would fix me something, and she would look at the clock and say, "You know, it's 6:30, your mom's almost home." And I'd go about a block down the street, and my mom would get home, and she'd say, "Did you eat?" And I'd say, "No, I didn't eat." And she would fix me dinner. And so food became that thing that filled that hole where all that pain and emptiness and desire and need and indifference to life came from. And my first arrest was at about 7 or 8 years old, stealing model paint at a CVS or a Safeway or something like that, Thrifty's. I was with some kids. It was summer, and some kid went to go steal something, and I stole model paint. I didn't even have a model. I just stole the model paint. You know, and so obviously mom has to leave work to come and pick up her son. And, you know, in an elementary school, I would see some kid with something, a folder with a pencil envelope in it, or, you know, some kind of eraser or pen. And, I would sit there on the field and watch people, and then I'd go steal it, and then I would admire it on the way home. And because I couldn't take it home and show it to my mom, and I couldn't take it back to school to use it, I would throw it in the trash. See, you had something I want, and the problem was because I felt so poorly about myself and my situation, I had to steal it, and then once I stole it, I couldn't use it, and so it just became trash. And that, you know, continued on for a long time until about the age of 11, sixth grade graduation party. My friend Robert's dad owned a bar, and upstairs they lived on Western, just south of Melrose. And his dad was on vacation in Hawaii, and he decided to have a sixth grade graduation with about 30 sixth graders. And he said, "You're the biggest boy. You should drink the vodka with Sharon Larkin. She wants to drink vodka." And so today I'm still friends with Sharon Larkin. I tell her that she's the reason I'm an alcoholic. And she broke my heart in like the 10th or the 5th grade. And she always kind of she laughs at that. But what happened that Friday night was I ended up on the neighbor's front lawn at 6 o'clock in the morning, passed out. You know, and that's not the reason for my alcoholism, but the reason I drank the alcohol was to fit in, right? To be one of those people, because I was less than all those people, right? So I had to drink that vodka, no matter even if I didn't want to. I had to try it. And so a couple years later, you know, we were just talking to Phil. I was talking with Brent Gill. I grew up with some Gills, and I remember going on this camping trip, and, you know, I was probably about 12, and the kids that were 14 were smoking pot, and so I smoked some pot, and they were drinking beers, and then, you know, eventually it would be go on the church camp out, and I'd have a six-pack of Schlitz Malt Liquor Bulls rolled up in my sleeping bag, you know, and I'd have a couple of joints, and I would go, and, you know, my plan was to just be able to drink and use those to be able to be comfortable enough to fit in, right? And then my mom used to take these pills, and I didn't know what they were, but I took one, and it just made me feel really wonderful. And they were called Mommy's Little Helpers in the 70s, Valiums. And what I learned is that Valium with Schlitz Malt Liquor beer, or Old English 800, was an incredible life-altering experience, you know. And I became Superman, right? And this little kid that went from not doing so bad in school was just overwhelmed by how was I going to fit into life, right? And so at 17 or 18 years old, I stopped going to school. Let's just say I stopped going to class. I went to school, and by that time it was alcohol and Quaaludes stealing cars and, you know, fighting and burglarizing houses and all this stuff. Not of my own volition, but because of the guys that I were hanging out with, right? C-Square or Chuck, I think we were talking, you know, about being 15, 16, 17 years old, and that's the experience. So today I'm riding a motorcycle and I'm wearing a Pendleton, and part of my experience was that I grew up in a really diverse neighborhood, Hispanic, Black, Arabic, some Irish kids, some German kids, you know, and we used to use all those negative connotations. You know, they call it racism today. We just thought it was making fun of each other. So for me, I didn't know what I was, right? So at some point in my life, I was a cholo, and at another point, I was a biker, and another point, I was a hot rodder, and another point, you know, I had all these costumes I wore in order to fit into wherever I was, you know, and I didn't have a clique. I didn't have a group of people. I just knew a lot of people. And I'll fast forward real quick. Terry Tinker is a guy I grew up with that I've known since I was about 7 or 8, 9 years old. And at my 20-year reunion, we had a conversation. I was sober at the time for about 3.5 years. And I said, God, it's too bad after all the years we couldn't have this conversation when we were growing up. And he looked at me and he says, no one seemed to know where you were at, because you never said anything and everybody was so terribly afraid of how you would respond. And I thought, wow. And all I was afraid, right? I was just afraid. Because I didn't know how to be. I didn't know what to be. You know, because I didn't have that example growing up in a house, right? I had a rather dysfunctional house. I mentioned to my friend, my new friend over here, Julie, that my dad was married 14 times. And that's not an excuse, and that doesn't make me a victim, by the way. If you're sitting here with a couple days or a couple hours or a couple of decades, and you're a victim, you will never recover from alcohol or drug addiction. No one's coming to rescue you. No one. And the person responsible for you is you. And until you put all that shit aside and say, so what, and move forward with now what, you will never have a life beyond your wildest dreams like my friend Stephen. That's the truth. That's what they didn't teach me. I have a friend in Alcoholics Anonymous. His name is Mario. He still talks like he came from a wetback family. No offense to this, as, you know, I tell him that there. He had a burro growing up. He said, if there's any reason to drink, because I was Hispanic, I had a burro, I didn't have a car. But he says, I didn't know what I didn't know before I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. And the first time he said that, I said, what does that mean? He says, you know, there's a lot of stuff I don't know about life and life's terms. And I don't know how to live on life's terms. And I learned how to live on life's terms in Alcoholics Anonymous by listening to the people in meetings and going through the book and going through the steps and getting somebody to direct me. And that made sense. I didn't know what I didn't know before I got to Alcoholics Anonymous. Because, see, Phil was teaching Phil. Phil's mom was out working. Phil's dad wasn't there. I had built up all these resentments at a young age, and I went through life responding to those resentments that I had. Chapter 5 is one of my favorite chapters. There are those, too, who suffer from grave emotional and mental disorders. And I didn't think that was me, because I thought I was totally normal, right? The reality is I'm not. I'm a neurotic. I overreact to normal situations because of how I feel emotionally, how I think you should treat me, my expectations of you, even though I don't tell you what they are. I essentially believe you should be a mind reader. And then I get terribly angry and I retaliate. I step on the feet of my fellows, right, and they retaliate. So I went in the military with a couple of other guys. I thought, you know, like Steve went to Nevada. I thought maybe if I go into the military, I'll learn some responsibility and some discipline and all these things, and I'll come out a better man and I'll succeed in life and all that stuff. And the reality was the night before I was supposed to show up, I went out with my buddies. I showed up at the house at 4:30 in the morning. My mom woke me up at 5:30. We were there at 6:30. I was hungover terribly after drinking Bacardi 151 and was miserable all day long. And they put us on a bus at 6 o'clock. And as the bus is leaving, I asked the bus driver, are you stopping anywhere between here and San Diego? He says, yeah, we have. I stop at a little store and let you guys get out and, you know, stretch your legs. And I said, can you buy me a bottle? And he says, yeah, if you buy me a bottle of schnapps. And I didn't have any money, so I said, sure. And, you know, because we're creative marketing people, you know, whether when it comes to drugs or alcohol, I walked back on this bus with a bunch of people. I only knew two out of the 60 kids on this bus, and I started taking collections, right? And some kid says, well, I've never... Well, I'm from Tennessee. I ain't never drank before, you know. And I said, that's all right. You'll love it. You'll love it. So gave this guy the money. We got about three or four cases of beer, a bottle of Bacardi for me and my three buddies, and a bottle for him. And we started drinking. And me and my buddies were sitting in the back of the bus. And shit, about an hour later, all these guys are throwing up in the, you know, in the bathroom is all clogged up and everybody's sick. And I just, you know, that you hear it all the time. Right. That first drink just took me right back to being okay. Right. And as we're getting off the bus, there's this kid, Brent. I still remember his name. He had all the paperwork for all those guys on that bus. And the guy, this little guy, he was the master chief and he was screaming, you've got to be shitting me, boy. How the hell? And my first thought was, you cannot go anywhere and not get in trouble. Your first day in the military and you're not even off the fucking bus. And thank goodness this kid was probably more afraid of me than I was of that situation, because he never said a word and I never got found out. But as it progressed, you know, it progressed to more drinking, more drugs, traveling overseas, and the experience with women. And so now I've been through food, alcohol, drugs, and now women, who I'm terribly afraid of. Even at 60 years old, I'm still afraid of girls. You're all girls, by the way. You know, I might put on a good show, but I'm terribly afraid. And... but, you know, there's an incredible thing called prostitution in the military when you're overseas, and you kind of lose some of your fear because it's, you know, it just is. And then I realized that, you know, I could be less afraid the more I drank. And so when I got back to the States, as long as I drank and I used drugs and then became a drug dealer, women were attracted to you because, you know, you had this power, right? You had something they wanted. And, you know, it was in the 80s. I went from, you know, driving around with a quarter gram of cocaine up, stashed up underneath the dash of my car. You know, that lasted me probably 2 weeks. And then I'm driving around a year later with 3 or 4 ounces on the front seat, you know, making deliveries, making money, and essentially an alcoholic crackhead, you know, in my 20s. And that didn't last very long because... my final experience there was I had to move in at 30 years old with my mom, and I was in her bedroom, and I was all paranoid, and I was drinking scotch, which she drank, and I don't even like scotch. And I thought I had dropped some rocks on the floor, and I was looking for them, and I found her Bible, her childhood Bible, in the bottom of a dresser, looking for crack cocaine. And I opened it up and started reading it, and it was Psalm 23. Yea, though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, I shall fear no evil, for thou art with me. And then I put the book down and took another hit and got back to reading. And, you know, I meant, who does that shit? You know? And I think that's normal, right? There's nothing normal about me in those days. So that's somewhere, you know, in my 30s. But I got arrested for drugs in high school. I got sentenced to Narcotics Anonymous. First, I went into a meeting. You know, I was a young guy. I looked around this old room. By the way, if you're young here, and there's a couple younger guys, you too can be fat, bald, and gray if you stay with Alcoholics Anonymous. That's the only promise I can help you, and hopefully you'll get sober. So then my first pullover for drunk driving was at 20, and then I got arrested at 24, and then I got arrested at 28, and then I got arrested at 33, and I got sentenced to a year in jail as a habitual drunk driver. And, you know, I had the year and a half of alcohol school, three nights a week, no more of that, one day a week for 6 months. I had all these AA meetings I had to go to, and I had to clean up the fucking park on Saturdays and Sundays between, you know, 6 o'clock in the morning and 6 o'clock at night. And what I realized today is they were just trying to keep me away from drinking. But, you know, you can't keep an alcoholic or a drug addict away from doing what they do. It's just not possible. We're so creative, you know. So I would, you know, Friday night, Friday morning, Saturday morning, you know, 5 or 6 o'clock, I'd be on my way back from Hollywood. I'd tell my roommate, hey, call over there at the park and tell him that, you know, I had a flat tire, you know, and I live right across the street from the park, you know, and I would pick up a pint and I would go to the bathroom. I said, I'll be right there. I got to go to the bathroom. And I'd put the eight ball and the pint in the, you know, the toilet seat covers, and this way when we had our 2 hour break, I could go in there and get right, and I could go out and pick up trash and screw around. And, you know, and I'm an ass kisser, you know, I will smile and tell you you're right as long as it helps me. And and that's the way I was. And, you know, I would, that's how I got over, you know. I wasn't helping myself, but that's what I was doing. And then there was this guy, Tam and Bud, at the Garden Grove Volano Club where I used to go to for meetings to get my card signed. And back then, you could put your card in the basket, and in about 10 minutes into the meeting, they would give you back your card and you could leave, right? You didn't have to listen to all this bullshit for an hour and a half. And I would go out this door, and he would go out that door, and he'd say, hey, Phil, let me talk to you. And I said, I don't have time. I got to go home and wash my hair or whatever, you know, lie. Just leave me alone. And he'd say, let's go to another meeting. I'd say, leave me alone. I just want my card signed. And he would do this, you know. I had to be there, I don't know, two nights a week or three nights a week. And finally, after about 6 months, I said, okay, I'll go to a meeting with you. And he said, Saturday night, my roommate is speaking at the Garden Grove Lana Club, and, you know, it's a speaker meeting, and I'd never been to one. I said, okay, you know. And I go into this room, and there's probably, you know, 80, 90 people, and he says, good evening, everybody. My name is Jeff Curley, and I'm an alcoholic. And about halfway through his pitch about shooting dope and smoking crack and stealing from his family and hurting the women in his life and losing jobs and quitting on jobs and all the stuff that he did when he was a kid and when he was in middle age, you know, in his 30s. And I started crying because for the first time in coming to meetings, I had heard my story from a man that didn't look like me. And I could relate to him. And at the end of the meeting, I walked up crying and I said, please help me. And I didn't know what that meant. And the first time I said, I'm Phil A, he says, no, you're Phil Adams. And from now on, just you'll say Phil Adams, because if you're ever in the hospital, they won't know who Phil A is. And if you ever know who they are, find out what their last name is so that you can go visit them in the hospital. And so I get a lot of crap. As a matter of fact, my friend and cousin, older cousin Bill over here, we were talking last night that where I'm located, the guys I grew up with, whenever we talk about each other in our absence, it'll be fuck Phil Adams or fuck John Booth or fuck Johnny Feldman or fuck Jerry Lee. And one of the guys in AA had heard that. And so one night they called Phil Adams to share, and he said, fuck Phil Adams. And for the last 5 years, my first name has been fuck. My middle name has been Phil, and my last name has been Adams. But that's okay, because I know that is love. As sick as that sounds, I know that's love. And I love Alcoholics Anonymous today. So that's what it was like. And for any of you who are new, or even with time, I'd like to start with page 568, which is in the spiritual experience. And it starts in the second sentence. It says, most emphatically, we wish to say that any alcoholic capable of honestly facing his problems in the light of our experience can recover, provided he does not close his mind to all spiritual concepts. He can only be defeated by an attitude of intolerance or belligerent denial. We find that no one need to have difficulty with the spirituality of this program. Willingness, honesty, and open-mindedness are the essentials of recovery, but these are indispensable. And then it says, there is a principle which is a bar against all information, which is proof against all argument, and which cannot fail to keep a man in everlasting ignorance. That principle is contempt prior to investigation. And when I came back this time, by the way, my sobriety date is February 1st, 2012, and I was sober from 1993 to 2000 until I put principles behind personalities. I got angry at the people in AA. I got angry at my family. I got angry at my boss, and I said, fuck them, and I went back out for another 12 years. And as much as I tried to come back and get a couple days here and there, I could not stay. By the way, Rocky Keith back there, I was going out as he was coming in. And what a pleasant surprise to walk in the room this morning and see Keith here, right? Because I know Keith from the Monday night men's stag and the Saturday morning men's stag in Santa Clarita since I've been back, right? And he was coming in as I was going out. See, the only requirement for membership is a desire to stop drinking. You don't have to do the steps. It doesn't say that, right? Our primary purpose is to help another alcoholic to achieve sobriety. It doesn't say they have to go to meetings or they have to call me every day at 10:15. And if you call me at 10:16, fuck you, you can find another sponsor. Love and tolerance is our code. See, I got confused by all that shit because there's a lot of ways to get sober. Right? They say they interviewed the first 100 guys in AA, people in AA, and that none of them went through the steps the same. Right? So there's some requirements, right? There's some just basic requirements. A desire to stop drinking. It helps if you're willing and open-minded and don't have contempt. But see, I'm the king of contempt. I came here at 17, didn't want it. Came here at 20, didn't want it. At 24, 28, at 33, right? And then I'm back again at 51 years old, 8 years ago when I got my last drunk driving. Right. And I was locked up in my big house. I had all the stuff. I had 3 cars and 2 motorcycles and 17 suits and 47 pairs of shoes. Right. This poor kid from Los Angeles who had everything in a 3,000 square foot house and an ex-wife. Right. And none of it made me feel any better than I had felt. None of it. And I was locked up in my house in my master bedroom with a 6-pack of fifths of vodkas. And I was drinking. And at 8 o'clock in the morning, I called this man, Spencer Schramm, who for 12 years had continued to come by my house and leave a note that I love you. I hope you're doing well. And I called him and I said, I can't do this anymore. Please help me. I had to surrender one more time. But what I know today is my first sobriety from 1993 to 2000 was compliance sobriety. Just don't drink no matter what. I don't know if they say that up here. It don't work very fucking well. Hold on as long as you can, because that's what I did. I held on for almost 7 years, and I was shaking and trembling, and I was afraid, and I asked Ben Benedetti to be my sponsor. And all he said was, yes, come here. He put his arms around me, and he said, breathe. I didn't say anything else. Just breathe. I was so messed up mentally and emotionally and spiritually that I forgot to breathe, right? And Ben tried to teach me how to be peaceful. So this time coming back to Alcoholics Anonymous, I was watching a show called Drugs, Inc., right? Romancing my previous drug dealing passed, and the minute that cocaine went out on the picture, I was like, I need to go get an 8-ball, right? And I said, no, you got, couple weeks, you need to turn that channel, right? So I turn the channel and I put this movie on, and it's like Jaws, and the music goes dun 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 dun, and I feel myself start to go like this, and all of a sudden I think to myself, my whole life has been about some kind of stimulation. Sexual stimulation, food stimulation, alcohol, drugs, movies. And I, wow. So I turned the TV off and I picked up something as Bill sees it. And there's a part in there that says, the quote is something like, he hoped the next generation of Alcoholics Anonymous would focus on emotional sobriety. And I thought, wow, you know, I've been coming to AA since I was 17. I never heard emotional sobriety. What's this? So I started reading on emotional sobriety, right? And on page 52 and 53 of the 12 and 12, it talks a little bit about that. The most common symptoms of emotional insecurity are worry, anger, self-pity, and depression. These stem from causes which sometimes seem to be within us and at other times come from without. To take inventory in this respect, we ought to consider carefully all personal relationships which bring continuous or reoccurring trouble. It should be remembered that this kind of insecurity may arise in any area where instincts are threatened. And so any area means my romantic, my family, my work, my social AA, right? See, the problem is I'm neurotic and I overreact to every situation because I'm emotionally and mentally unsound. There are those two who suffer from grave emotional and mental disorders. Fuck! That wasn't me 5 minutes ago, but it sure is me now. Right? So it goes on to talk about, if my disturbance was seemingly caused by the behavior of another, why do I lack the ability to accept conditions I cannot change? And it goes on. It talks about our total inability to form a true partnership with friends, family, and society as a whole. And then I read, God, that's Phil Adams. I can't form a relationship with a woman romantically or my family or my boss. My boss is an asshole. It's all his fault. I should have his job. He should work for me. They should pay me more, right? It's this continuation of this child that's 5 years old. He's unhappy, and now he's a fucking 55-year-old adult who's unhappy, and nothing's fucking changed. But I'm sober. Right? The same man will drink again. See, you can take a horse thief and sober him up, but what do you got? A sober horse thief, right? If you don't do the work, ain't nothing going to change. You're just going to have what they call cakebox sobriety. Do they have cakebox sobriety up here? No? So cakebox sobriety, one of my sponsors said, is Phil, you know, you're reading the directions on the side of the box and putting the box back on the counter and hope that the fucking cake will make itself. You got to take the action on the side of the box to get the cake. He says, do you get what I'm saying? I said, I get it, right? I got to do the action. So there's another part in here. Step three was real struggle for me. Correct me if I'm wrong. I have, 37 seconds? Is that right? Is that what I have? Okay. I grew up in a Greek Orthodox church. The priests used to wear this big headdress and all this gold, and they spoke in another language, and they did the incense, and it sounded like this. Gospodi pomiluj, Gospodi pomiluj, Gospodi pomiluj. And my friends that would go to church, they'd say, well, how do you know when to stand up, sit down, cross yourself, go up and... I said, I just follow my grandmother. Right? I have no idea what... See, that was God to me. I didn't even understand it. So how am I supposed to get a God of my own understanding from that, right? But I knew that throughout the world, people in every culture for thousands of years had understood a power greater than themselves. The Polynesians, the Turkish, the Christians, the Jews, the Tibetans, the Buddhists, all these people had a different understanding. And then I used to think that, you know, maybe there's just one power greater than ourselves. He just has different faces for different people. And the way that came about was I was in Korea, and I walked into an older church, and I saw this Christ that was Korean. I swear to you, he had Korean eyes and the same clothes, but I thought, well, that's not Christ. I mean, that's a Korean guy dressed up as Christ. And then somebody says, yeah, but it says God made in our own image, right? And they said, so God looks like everybody. And I think, oh, my God, right? So that drives me to start meditating on the Lord's Prayer. You know, it's a Christian prayer. That's okay. It's just they're words, right? They're words. They're just words. God is just a word. But he sure gets blamed for a lot of shit, right? Our Father. So if I take that statement just by itself, our Father, that means that all of us are related. We're a family. Not just in AA, but out there in the world. Who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Thy kingdom come, thy will be done on earth as it is in heaven. Right? We have this God hole, right? So what happens on the outside is relative to the inside. You made a comment to it, right? C square. That it's an inside job. We hear it all the time. And the only time I have the opportunity to have a program of sobriety is right here, right now, with you, where I'm at. And it'll never be the same than right here, right now, ever again. Thy kingdom come, thy will be done on earth as it is in heaven. Forgive us our trespasses as we forgive those who trespass against us. And all of a sudden this light. Now see, I've been saying this prayer since I was a little boy in church, right? In English, but I never got it until I was about 52 years old in an AA meeting, and I thought, oh shit, I only feel forgiven when I start forgiving. Right? Forgive us our trespasses as we forgive those who trespass against us. Lead us not into temptation, that's my job. Deliver us from evil, that's my job, etc. Right? So I'm in a meeting a couple days later, and not a normal meeting for me, and this woman says at the end of the meeting, after a minute of silence for the alcoholics who still suffer in and out of these rooms, would you please join me in the Lord's Prayer? And I thought, a minute? What the fuck am I going to do for a minute? Well, this is what I've learned in AA in some 43 years. I pray when I don't know what to do. That's what I do. I pray. And so this prayer came to me at the end of this meeting. God, thank you for the blessing of this day, this place, these people, these lessons that I've learned. For your love, your strength, your forgiveness, your power, your acceptance, and your patience, and for my ignorance. Amen. And then we got up to do this prayer. And since then, what happens at the end of every AA meeting, once they read a vision for you, is I say that prayer in the silence, even if it takes a little longer to stand up and be with the room. See, what I realized today is I don't want to bookend God. I don't want to bookend God at the beginning of my day. God, please direct me in my thinking and my actions. And then at the end of the day, God, I really fucked up today because you weren't involved in the middle. See, I don't want to bookend God, so I have a time to go ahead and reflect. We read, you know, this morning, right, and talked about that. We talked about his spiritual experience, right? If you haven't had one, they are real. They're hard to explain. My first one was I had $53. I had a bill for $50. I wrote the check. I was suffering. And 3 days later, I got a check from an old bank account for $157. That kept me over till Friday. See, I don't know how that stuff happens, right? It just does, right? Today, there's God's plan. Yesterday, we're leaving, and I said, you know what? There's Phil's plan. It made me a little late, and then there's God's plan, and Steve and Ben start laughing. We're at Stepping Stones in Santa Clarita, and we get up here, we have dinner with these wonderful people, and then Ben says, I got to go. And I said, God's plan. And then, you know, jokingly, I said, I don't even like these people up here. And that's only because of Marcy and Bill. They're really dicks. But you know that. I don't have to share that with you. Where is Marcy? He's probably doing... Oh, is he still there? I love Alcoholics Anonymous. And what I felt last night coming here is that we fit in. You know, we apologize to everybody else in the room if we had annoyed them, which we did. And I'm looking for something else I set up in here. In step three, where did it go? Oh, so on page 63, so the God thing. You know, I've seen a lot of things in AA, which is confusing, and that's driven me to personalities, right? Most recently, I watched a lot of people take newcomers into like the IHOP where we live and then say, you know, we're going to do the third step prayer in the middle of the aisle with 70 people having breakfast, and that'll teach you some humility. And I think, you know, let me read through the third step again and find out where it says you got to be in an IHOP in the aisle and you need to lose humility. And I said, well, that's because they need to learn humility. I said, can you show me in the book where it says that your job is to teach somebody how to have fucking humility? Because you're exactly the motherfucker that caused them to go back out because you have no love and tolerance. And they go, you're angry, Phil. All right. So this is what I read. We thought well before taking this step, making sure we were ready, that we could be at last abandoning ourselves utterly to Him. So this is, see, what I learned from my last couple of guys was I want to be with somebody who's in the book, who knows the book, who follows the book. Not his opinion, I think you should, blah, blah, blah. And there's some good in that, but the book is the foundation for what we do, right? And so if you don't think you make a difference in AA, you're terribly wrong. And what I mean by that is about over 100 years ago, some people in the Washingtonians helped a guy, and ultimately they become the Oregonians or the Oxford group. And then the Oxford group made an impact on Alcoholics Anonymous, right? And Ebby helped Bill, who helped Bob, who helped thousands or millions of people. And today, over 80 plus years of Alcoholics Anonymous, we're in a room. And the thing that I glean from that I grasp onto, that I think about every day that I go to a meeting, because I drank and used every day, I go to a meeting every day, is that if I think about helping somebody and I don't do it, when I think about that person that comes to mind who's a newcomer or an old timer, and I think I should probably call them and check in on them, if I don't, what are the ramifications of my not taking action? See, I think God works through me and through my thoughts. That when I think of somebody, my reaction is to call them to see that they're okay. And that's contrary to me, because if I put my thoughts, oh, they don't want to hear from me. Oh, you know, they're if any one of those men in the last 100 years had delayed helping another person, we might not be sitting here. And as you go out into the world, you know, there's people out there that struggle from our disease daily, everywhere, in the markets, in restaurants. You know, people say, why do you say you're a member of Alcoholics Anonymous so loud? Because my sponsor says, you never know when that might help somebody. And you'd be surprised how many people come up and say, you know, I have a son, I have a daughter, I have a husband. They have this problem. How do I get some help, right? And see, the job today for Alcoholics Anonymous for me is to help another alcoholic to achieve sobriety, even when they don't want to be sober. Right. And Steve said this, I think, last night. You know, we were talking about his brother, who's one of us. He just doesn't want what we have, or he doesn't know that he wants what we have. And I apologize for sharing this. But You know, he promises to be there on mom's birthday and Christmas and Thanksgiving and Easter, just like I did to my mom, and I was missing for 5 years because I was doing what I was doing. And I killed my mom's heart because of my selfishness, right? And so Steve says, the only thing I can do is be an example, right? We're all an example, right? Jokingly, we're all a good example of Alcoholics Anonymous and a bad example of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I'm both all the time. I'm loud, obnoxious. I think everything's fucking funny because where I come from, everything was tragic. You know, and the book talks about that. Sometimes people be laughing about the most tragic shit. We're not a glum lot. See, that's my escape, right? We're not a glum lot. I can laugh at everything. I'm sorry your dog died. Oh, I didn't mean to talk about your dog, Steve. So, about a year and a half ago, I'm talking with Steve as he shows up in Santa Clarita, and he's telling me, yeah, you know, I was in a relationship, and I went to a detox, and you know, I was doing this, and I was doing that, and you know, and he says, yeah, and you know, so one morning I wake up, and my head's sore, and my back's sore, and my legs are sore, and he says, I feel like I've been beat up, and my car's not there, and I said, what's going on? And they said, maybe you should go back to the bar, and goes back to the bar, and the owner says, come back here to the office, and he says, just sit down. He says, what happened? He says, just wait, and he puts up the security footage, and here's, you know, Steve at the bar, it's, you know, back then he weighed 110 pounds and he's screaming apparently at this bartender who's 6'9 and 300 pounds. And then he runs around to kick the guy's ass and the guy throws him and plummets him and, you know, body slams him. And he didn't even remember any of this. And Steve says in pure alcoholic fashion, does this mean I can't drink here anymore? Right? And I start laughing and I think, that's fucking me. Right? I'm really sorry, but he says there's only two bars in town and the guy owns both and he needs to make sure that he can drink there. See, I get that. But he leaves, right? He's digging the ditch. He decides to leave. And then he's talking about, my girlfriend has my dog. My dog. My girlfriend. On Facebook, I got a text, I got that. I said, man, go get the fucking dog. And he goes, I can't. I said, why not? He says, because she has it. I go, no, that's the only thing that attaches you to her. And you know you're not going to be with her because you're here. And she doesn't want to be sober and you do. So go get the fucking dog and unfriend her on Facebook. I can't. Fuck. So a couple days later he goes, the dog died. I said, what? You killed my dog. I said, I didn't kill your fuck. You didn't care about the dog. I said, no, I cared. I said, but you know what? I said, I do believe in the big book. I do. And there is this thing called God doing for you what you cannot do for yourself. God killed the dog. I didn't say the God killed the dog part. But see, God doing for us what we cannot do for ourselves. So this guy, and I understand, see, my MO with relationships, and we talked about relationships, is that, you know, I would get her, and I would cheat on her, and then when it was time to leave her, I would make sure that I got her for sure before I let go of her, right? That's my MO, because I don't want to be alone, right? I don't want to be lonely. Because who am I left with? Me. And I don't know how to be with me. And the only way I know how to be with me is to get fucked up. So I need to learn how to be with Phil. So Phil likes, I love people, and I like peacefulness also, right? I love Steve. You know, he is active in his own sobriety, right? Steve is responsible for Steve. And so this morning I ask him a question. I look at him face to face and I said, how's your life today? And he says, it's wonderful. Without hesitation. And, you know, the problem is that I tell myself these stories from childhood that end up being my stories in adulthood. And a guy who's really important to me in my sobriety was a guy by the name of Harry Tebow. And he was on the board of Alcoholics Anonymous until 1967. And he was a psychiatrist that worked with Freud and Carl Jung. And he has this writing called King Baby. And he believes, in his opinion, that the same things as a child. We cry, we get suckled, our mother takes care of us, that 40, 50, 60 years later, we're just big babies who cry and want attention of some sort. We either want to be the funny guy that everybody laughs at that wants to be around. We want to be the handsome guy, you know, that goes away too. The guy who's in good shape, that goes away too. The guy who has a nice car, the guy who has a good job, the guy who has a great house. All these personalities, and I think there's 11 or 13 of them. And it's all about getting some kind of acknowledgement and some kind of acceptance. And the reality is that I'm looking for acceptance on the outside, and like my friend said, it's an inside job, right? So when I learn how to be quiet and calm and peaceful, and I have a consciousness, right, step 11, sought through prayer and meditation. So prayer and meditation. So if you don't think you know how to pray or you don't know how to meditate, you do. And this is what I've learned. So when I'm driving along the freeway, before Alcoholics Anonymous, and somebody cuts me off, and I say, God, let that motherfucker get in the car crash. That's a prayer. It is. It's a negative prayer, but it's still a prayer, right? And then I think about that guy who cut me off all day long, and at 6 o'clock that night, I'm thinking, that motherfucker, that motherfucker, that motherfucker, that motherfucker, right? Meditation is about repetition, right? So I know how to pray and meditate. But it's not like that today. It's more about God, forgive that person, you know, and yeah, I do that too. See, now I'm just like them, right? And then I asked Steve this morning, let's read the daily meditation so that we can plant a seed, because what will happen is I'll think about that seed all day long. It will come back to me, right, about repetition, repetition, meditation, meditation, about being kind, loving, and helpful. And that's not the Phil Adams that came here 43 years ago. I was definitely a liar, cheat, and a thief. I stole materially. I stole love. I stole food. I stole things, right, to feel better, and none of that ever worked. And today I know that if I put myself second and I put you and the people out there first, and that I am active in my own sobriety and I help another alcoholic to achieve sobriety, and I'm of service, my life is better as a result. Thanks for letting me share.